hearted participation. Please be undivided in giving your attention. That will be best for you to receive, and also it affects everybody else. And to the extent that video is possible for you, please also be on video, fully present in that way. Then respect for the sanctity of the teachings and the presence of each person, certainly our esteemed guest, Satchidananda Swami. Respect creates a very safe and sacred space. And determination that I want to put into action what is being given today. It really requires a certain spirit from us, an orientation that I am determined to apply what I learn, to shift my paradigm closer and closer to the spiritual, away from the default of the material, the ego, going towards the soul. So your full-hearted participation, respect, and determination are wanted. Thank you. And Satchidananda Swami is my guru. He is a very, very dear guide to us at UpBuild for so many years since its inception. The inspiration, one of the main inspirations behind the work that we do. And it's a tremendous honor to have him. He travels around the world sharing his teachings. He's been a monk for more than 50 years. And he's right now, actually, he's gone from Germany, where he's been with us the past few weeks, to now United States. So he is on U.S. soil, and we're preparing eagerly to have him in New York, where we'll have our UpBuild in-person programs. But it's amazing to have him in the same country now. We also are appreciative to have everybody else Zooming from around the world, and we hope you'll join us in New York as well. The format of this series, How Material Life Doesn't Work, is that Satchidananda Swami will tell a story from his personal life. He has so many rich experiences, so many realizations that it's just a treasure, and we want to take stock of everything we can. So he will share with us a story and translate that for us, how that applies to us as well. And then we'll close with questions as time permits. So please come up with your questions as you're listening. Listen very actively and think, what is it that I need to understand more of, or I need to figure out how can I apply more of? And note that down and send to Michael Sloyer. You can raise your hand. You can direct message him, as always, with your questions at any time. And then we'll close at the top of the hour officially for anyone who needs to go. And please also stay with us afterwards if you can. We'll do more Q&A for another half an hour. Satchidananda Swami is very kind to give us that time. Let us really take advantage of it. This is the last story that he'll be sharing with us in a larger format. The next week, our final week, is going to be a Q&A session that will be the bulk of our time together. So this is part 4 of 5, the last of the stories. And with that, let us excitedly hear from Satchidananda Swami. Over to you. Thank you.
Again, it is my great pleasure to address all of you from the UpBuild community. And in this last episode, I would really like to share with you the dire consequences that happen when we are in the material outlook of life. It is said, when the self is lost, everything is lost. Just a few months ago, actually, it was the end of the summer, 25, there was a man walking up and down before our ashram who was not dressed. He was undressed. I remember I went to him, but I was very hesitant to confront him, because I don't know, you know, when someone is mad, for instance, or aggressively schizophrenic and so on, you are yourself in danger. So then our neighbor, who lived four houses up the road, called to me, "Can you be with him? I'm calling the police." And it was a young lady, and of course I thought, well, a naked man walking up and down the street with disheveled hair, now I have to step in. It doesn't matter that I'm a monk and not so, I'm not a healthcare professional. This lady is perhaps in danger. So I went to the person while the lady got on a mobile telephone to try to get the police. I asked the man, "May I know your good name?" And he just stared at me. Why are you here? Are you here on holidays? Or are you just... I tried to somehow make contact with him, but I felt very, very strange and a little bit afraid that he would come out of his stoic peace and just pounce on me. I continued to ask questions, but he just was silent to each question, and he did not really respond to any of my questions. He was stark naked, and dusk settled into night. It was that atmosphere where you don't want to be alone with a naked man on a road far away from civilization. On the other side of the road, there was a deep, dark forest. Then I asked him, "Can you remember anything?" And he looked at me, and for the first time, there was a spark in his eye. What happened before you were stark naked? And again he was silent. He struggled to remember. And by now, I started to look up the road if the police would come and if they knew how to deal with this. But I was all alone with the man. The lady was gone. I was there, and darkness settled in. I asked all kinds of questions, but he just struggled to perceive the query. Then finally, I don't know why, but the dam started to show a hole, and something came through from the other side. He said, I went for holidays here. He spoke a broken form of German. Acha, oh, yeah, really? How? And then a little bit more came. He really struggled. I came with a tent, and I put up the tent. Then I went outside of the tent. Then I put it up, and I went inside. Then I went outside. Why did you go outside? Well, I wanted to take a bath in the lake. please, my dear people, his words came really trickling, and now I tell them to make up complete a sentence. They did not complete a sentence. They were just fragments of a sentence. And as I talked more and more and encouraged him to struggle more, I also went back in our house and took a towel so that he could put it and cover his private parts. It was clear he had gone for holiday in our area. We live at a lake. Our gracious host has visited us and knows where we are, and he had pitched up his tent, and then somehow when he came out of that tent, maybe something hit him on the head, or maybe there was not such a dramatic thing. He forgot everything. As I tried to put the story together, the police came, and they were really there with guns. They had heard from the lady, a naked man was there, and said, "No need, no need, no need. He's not. He has been very." I don't see him as a danger, but he is in grave danger. He has forgotten everything. "Well," said the police, "has he a passport?" I said, "Look at him, he's naked. The towel which you see at him is not his. It is from our ashram. How can he carry a passport?" So then the police inspector inquired from him, but then my man totally shut off again, because maybe he felt intimidated or I don't know. But I had by now some information and said, "You have to perhaps look at one of the places where one can put up a tent, and then if there is an empty tent, you have to see if you can find a passport, and then you can take it from there." So they were grateful. They took my address for further support, and they took him in the car. And the man looked at me, I never forget how he looked out of the car. It was not a car, it was a bus, a police bus. He looked so helpless, so sad, because when the self is lost, everything is lost. This is a statement from the philosophy, from the ancient wisdom text: when the self is lost, everything is lost. I did not hear back from the police. I think they must have dealt with this situation in whatever way. I cannot tell you how they have dealt with it. But I want to use this as a story to illustrate that if we forget our identity, then we have to learn a new identity. I have done some inquiry from a psychologically trained professional person, and have asked him, what do you do? Oh, they say, this is a case of total amnesia. Please help me with the word. I turn here to Guru Krishna. Is it? Yeah, yes. Say it again.
Amnesia.
Amnesia. Okay. And usually they need to put him into an institution and then teach him something new, you know, a new identity. But that person will never ever be totally satisfied in his new so-called identification, because the identity is something else. I never forget this sad glance. Can you help me? But I'm not trained. I cannot do more than a professional care institution can do for him. I was very sad. And then I went into our house, our little ashram house, and I prayed for this unknown man who has come into my life and has exited my life on that fateful evening where I gave him a towel as the only help I could think of before the police took over. And they are good people. We live in a village. They are not village, small town. They must have done something for his benefit. So this is our situation. In this world, all of us have forgotten our true identity. And yes, we learn some identifications, but we will never be totally satisfied and happy unless we return our rediscover our identity. By the way, this is how the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita start. They, in the second chapter, after the first chapter deals with the preparing the stage and telling us what happened in the time when the Gita was spoken. After doing that, the Bhagavad Gita quickly comes to the essence of dealing with identity, because without having the identity clear in our life, everything which we do in regards with our identification will not satisfy us. We have so many identifications which we had adopted, which are not our identity. Our Instagram projections, Facebook, so-called identity, career identity, Sunday identity, when I am relaxing, Monday identity, when I go into my job, and so on. But who are we under all these layers of identification is often not known, and then it's not known also to what we should really do in our life. We are always disturbed. As I said, the Bhagavad Gita starts here, and Krishna, knowing that Arjuna is a problem, he is suffering because he has an identity problem, he says, he sees, I see you are full of grief, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. The Bhagavad Gita starts with this existential crisis. You are mourning Sochan, and the Gita ends with saying, I shall deliver you from all your karma. Do not mourn, do not fear. Masuchaha. You know, the beginning starts with suchaha, suffering, and the end is do not fear. Just keep these teachings in your mind, live by them, and you will be free. free from the fear which comes when we are not clear about our identity, but we live in our only surrogate identifications. I have good news for you. The Bhagavad Gita talks very positively about the identity. It says, never was there a time when I did not exist, Krishna speaking, nor you, nor all these people. There was never a time when we did not exist, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. We are eternal. We are eternal spirits in the material world. And Krishna continues. Let me see if I can read this for you. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. So Krishna goes on that your suffering is like the non-permanent appearance of the seasons. There's winter, then there is spring, there's summer, there's autumn, there's winter. One must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. These ups and downs, which come like seasonal changes, can be tolerated when one is not disturbed, when one is on the spiritual level of knowing who they are. When I came out of the airport, airplane, we had taken a flight from London to Pittsburgh. I had an interesting experience of suffering due to forgetting and happiness due to remembering. I was in the line towards the immigration officer. I had a passport, a current passport, but my visa for America, I had been given a 10-year visa, was in an old passport that I carried along. I needed my current passport to be found in the system, and I also needed the old one so that it was clear that I had a visa. So when I came closer to the immigration, I looked for both of these passports, but they were not there. The line was coming closer and closer and closer. And I know the immigration officers are very often tired. They have seen so many people, and they are often for visitors a little tough, because their duty is to not let anyone into the country who brings with him a whole list of potential disturbances. They are not known for being kind. When they have done their job, you can speak with them and they are kind. But when they are on the job and they check you, if you're not an American, they will let you know that they will now be very tough with you. In my mind was the memory of one of the immigrations where I had forgotten that I needed to produce the addresses of people who had invited me. So I did not know all of this, and that they asked me to tell my telephone number. I said, I have no telephone number. I don't use telephone. And so many things I could not supply, and then they were very suspicious, and they were bringing me into the area of you know, behind the immigration, and whew, and if there would not have been a kind devotee who just broke through all the lines and told him, he's an impractical monk, you know, I have all the information, I would have been strangled to death or hung up outside. I'm joking. They would have sent me back. So I had this idea, and the fear was coming on. Now, if this is another scenario like this, and I don't have my, where's my passport? I looked everywhere, and I couldn't find the passport, and the line was coming closer, and already the immigration officer looked at me, who's coming there, and he's dressed in such beautiful colors, you know, I always go as my monk dress, and I called back to the line, is there my passport somewhere on the ground? I shouldn't have done it, because everyone thought I'm deflecting. I have something hidden under my... I was not, you know, this is unusual. And then I looked. The passport was gone. There was no passport. Then I started to chant the mantra. If you ever lose something, this mantra brings you to the lost object. Om Hanumate Namaha. I chanted it. Om Hanumate Namaha. Om Hanumate Namaha. And suddenly I remembered, my God, my passport. Not my one passport, my two passports. One for the visa and this and the other. So I must have put them where my dhoti is, you know, in the line. So I reached there and I found the passport just when my line came to the officer, and I said, today I'm the most happy person in the universe. I stuck my, what is your name? They were not ready for a joyful Swami, you know. So I switched and gave all the information, and in the end, he wished me all the best. It went all right. But my dear everyone, when we lose the soul, we may, in a way, try to deflect and try to cover it up. But you can never be happy until you find it. It's almost like the passport. And the interesting thing which is here is the soul is always with you, just like the passport was always with me. I was only separated from my passport by a screen of forgetfulness. I think I know why I stuck it in that unlikely place where you don't stack passports. Usually it's so unreliable as a place to put it. I looked for my addresses where I would stay so that I could inform the inspector that I'm going here and here. And so on. So I'm using this as an analogy, that just like the person who wants to cross a certain border is in total anxiety when he is not in knowing where his passport is, in the same way, we are always in total anxiety when we do not know where the soul is, that we are the soul. And this anxiety is manifesting in different ways. And anxieties that we do not, that we might lose our position, our prestige, our contacts, our relationships. This all types of fears come from that one fear of losing the body, and this of finding death, and this fear is based on a loss of our eternal identity, our loss of who we are. Now we live in a civilization where this is glossed over. I want to read you something which I found. If someone tells a lie loud and long enough, others begin to accept it as the truth. This sentence, by the way, comes from the propaganda minister of Germany under Hitler. His name was Goebbels. He said, if someone tells a lie loud and long enough, others begin to accept it as truth. The Nazi history shows this. When enough people are convinced by that so-called truth, it becomes a culture. If that culture is somehow transmitted to the next generation, it becomes a tradition. Such traditions and the world views and behaviors they espouse become etched into society, followed by millions, usually without question. My dear everyone, the lie which has become a truth that morphed into a culture and is a tradition is that we are something else than the eternal soul. And everyone acts on it in their jobs, in the universities. Mass instruction weapons, means educational systems, media powerhouses, community structures, all of them reinforce these materialistic worldviews and traditions, causing the untruth to perpetuate itself over the decades and centuries. But nevertheless, what cannot be taken away from us is that soft, soft voice of the soul that comes from underneath all these so-called surrogate identifications which we take on in jobs, in relationships, in positions, and so on. The truth of the soul comes through in a simple question. Am I missing something? Perhaps I'm missing something. And this little voice becomes amplified and becomes louder, and forms into a longing. I think I'm not connected with my true self. I think I'm only in identifications. And I will say it in New York language, damn it, I'm not happy with this. No? I could express it more cultural, alas. I'm not happy with this. The longing becomes stronger and stronger. And everyone knows about this voice. It's almost like, you know, when there is an earthquake and people get buried under debris, means old structures from old, their old houses. This hear these heartbreaking stories of soft voices moaning and groaning under the debris, and they come out, and then the rescue workers know, there's another person living, we have to rescue them. So, my dear listeners, you have to do some rescue work of your true self, because everything does not really make sense when you have lost your identity. Think back of that person, that helpless person whom I met at the street in dusk, who was naked, and his hair was disheveled, and he looked with me at me with eyes which I couldn't read his expression. I was afraid, actually, until I found out that he had been struck by a sudden forgetfulness when he was going to the lake to take his bath. In the area where we live, there are beaches where people go into the lake uncovered. You know, they go without any dress. It is socially very well accepted. It's a form of German culture. They call it the free body culture. It's not everyone's taste, but some people appreciate this. So I still remember this person, and I never want to become that much bewildered, where I just forget my eternal self, and then get in return all these anxieties which come when I identify with a temporal self, temporal identification, which is based on the physical body. I have something else here. Oh yeah. Rediscover identity. Some people will tell us spirituality comes later when we are in a mature age. But those who know how important it is to rediscover their spiritual identity will say, no, this comes first and super first. When you drive, your life is a journey. When you start your journey, when, at which point do you know which goal you should go to? Is this coming later? Maybe when you are 2 or 3 hours into the journey, then you ask the question, where do we go to? No, you must know immediately at the very outset, because you have to adjust your GPS according to it, otherwise you waste your time. So when you don't know at the outset of what you do who you are, you are setting yourself up for a lot of wasted time, a lot of time which is perhaps difficult to buy back. You would see at the time of death, when all these constructions of and wrong identifications fall to the ground, collapse, you will regret every minute that is wasted without knowing the true self and true goal of the self. People tell you, jobs come first, relationships come first. But they come second after you know who you are and what makes you happy. If you live in these false roles, you will only be deceived. Another thing which you might have learned is, I have a soul. That's wrong. You are a soul and you have a body at the present moment. We are not. There's this one sentence which I once heard. You are not human beings who seek for a spiritual experience. You are spiritual souls who have at the moment a very human experience. It's something like this. I have to paraphrase it because I don't entirely know. So in this world, there are so many lies which are told loud enough and long enough so that others, including yourself, have accepted them as truth. And these so-called truths have become cultures and traditions that are perpetuated. There is a time where you have to just say, stop now. And please don't do what many do. They say, someday I will take care of this. I understand. Swamiji, your message was clear today. I understand. But my dear everyone, there are 7 weekdays. Monday, Tuesday, etc. all the way to Sunday. And there is no someday amongst these 7 days a week. There is no someday. I have thoroughly studied it in preparing this lecture. Maybe I had overlooked the someday I take care of my spiritual life. You never know. But no, I didn't find it, and I think I will never find it. They have a. Here is. Can you share an example of self? In a moment, I will do this. I wanted to do this. My dear everyone, the spiritual discovery which you do in order to come to this, or let us say the spiritual practice I wanted to say, which you do in order to come to the true self, is something like spiritual archaeology or saving yourself from the debris, being burdened from the debris. It does take a little discipline. And discipline is always a little uncomfortable for some of us. But the pain of regret is unbearable. It's simply unbearable. So I want to encourage you to joyfully start your spiritual discovery and get to the essence, find your true self that is buried under all these roles and masks and so-called identifications which you resort to when you do not, when you are not connected to the true self. This is what I wanted to share with you. I hope it is not too strong. There was one question by Diana Ross, I think, or one Mrs. Ross or Mr. Ross. It is, can you share an example of the true self? What was exactly the question? Michael, you, I think, have them all, and you can tell us.
Yeah, Sachinanda Swami, that was the full question from Ross. Can you share an example of the self?
Me is an example. You are an example. We all are a self. But we need to uncover it. It is covered with our mind, intelligence, and ego, and it is covered with the body. It is inside there. So an example of it is, yes, you need to only go to these people who have gone or who are on the path of self-realization. Usually what strikes you when you see them is they are extremely tolerant. The second quality which strikes you is they seem to be connected with the source of happiness that cannot be given to the world by the world and also not taken away from the world. The next quality which they have is they have wisdom. And another quality which I have seen, they are usually not afraid. They are very grounded. They have lost all fear. An example of such a self-realized person, I always found an example in my spiritual master. At the last end of his life, he had a type of swelling for which he needed a certain powder which made him look all white. So once after applying the powder, he started to laugh. We were all very solemn and we were all very sad to see him undergoing the sufferings of dying. And we asked him, "You're jolly?" He said, "Yes, I look now like Lord Shiva, who's all white." He has a whitish complexion that is illuminating his environment like the moon. And we could see he was not identified with the body. He was not afraid of death. And you know what I see? These self-realized persons, they can instill fearlessness into others. Once, one of my god sisters, a disciple of the same spiritual master, came with her little daughter. The daughter was 14 years old, or 15 years old, to my spiritual master. The daughter had a disease, and she had gone to the sacred place where my spiritual master was at that time, Vrindavan in India, to give up her body in a favorable atmosphere, sacred atmosphere. But of course she was afraid of her death and her mother was totally upset. So they came to my spiritual master to look for some counsel. And my spiritual master said with so much confidence, "Don't be afraid a bit. No one in this world lives for long. You are now going soon to change this body, just like you have changed so many times your shirt and your dress." And as he spoke, something happened. I have listened to the audio recording and I want to play it over the weekend when I give my seminar. here in Moundsville in West Virginia. In the beginning, the mother cries and the daughter is really nervous and upset. And into the conversation, the mother's crying stops. And at the end, my spiritual master asked the girl, "Do you have any further questions?" And she just says with such a joyful voice, "No, I'm absolutely satisfied, and I'm free from anxiety and fear." And you know, someone can say this, but by the sound of the voice, you know what is really going on. And by the sound of her voice, you could understand. She had, due to her contact with the self-realized person, she had lost her fear. Therefore, on the path of spiritual discovery, it is very good to have people around you in your life who are living examples. Even if they are not totally self-realized, if they are on the path with sincerity, you will benefit from their association tremendously. And I believe that is what you have created here for, in the Upbuild community, where you have this session, Discover Who You Are. Is it Discover Who You Are or
Remembering Who We Are?
Remembering Who We Are. Mm-hmm. That's very good. I hope this satisfies your inquiry to some degree of satisfaction.
Thank you so much, Satchinandana Swami, and thank you, Ross, for your question. We will go to Anshul. Would you kindly ask your question?
Pranam, Satchinanda Swami, thank you for all that you shared. As I explore the spiritual journey and trying to connect with my deeper sense of self and soul and consciousness, there's one part which feels a practice which is alone, which means the meditation and the philosophy, and that's one part of the journey. And the second part of the journey, and I know they're correlated, is the application of that soul to the world around us. So, for example, if I think about connecting with loved ones, as I go through this journey, I feel an opening, and an opening to love more deeply and to love more widely. And so that resonating energy allows further opening. So I've started to feel a little glimpse of that with people. The part that I struggle with is more the application to work. And so when I think about this opening or connecting with soul and spirit, how is it that my work changes to be more purposeful or more expansive and driven from a different place than maybe driven by ego or external factors? But ultimately, it's hard to decipher when your work is actually driven from that place, coming from the eternal soul, versus coming from temporal identification. And so my question is how you might help us reflect on deciphering the work we do in the world and when it comes from the eternal soul.
Wonderful. I understand totally your question, Anshul, and I'm very it's a very relevant question. What do we do with this understanding when we go to work? It can be also in other fields. Anshul, there is one little technique, and perhaps in our retreat I will be able to explain it in further detail, that will help you to come to that place of eternal self and then go from that place again back into the work without getting lost in difficult motivations, for instance, or things which overcome us, you know, identification, disturbance when something does not work out, or being upset when we misunderstood, or when there are changes happening which are very difficult to negotiate at the time. There's one simple technique which will help you to deal with that, and it will bring you immediately to the place of the self. This is the technique. You step voluntarily out of being an involved person and enter into what is called in Sanskrit the Shakshit Vena. It's an observer role. You look at that time at your work or whatever is happening, it can be in various circumstances, from a distant place, almost like the video camera in your mobile telephone. Look at this video camera. All the impressions are coming in. This camera, it is processed in some ways. The light rays are processed and images are formed inside this little technical miracle. There's everything that, or there are many things that go on as you go through life, where things are entering your perception. Not just through the eye lenses, but the ears and the nose and so on. But there's one thing which is not there: identification with it. It's a neutral camera. It's a neutral observer, which observance which takes place. There's a beautiful poem which I like to paraphrase for you, written by Rumi. He said, our human life is like a guest house. Receive every guest at the entrance with kindness. Some are pleasant guests, some are difficult guests. And see them like a receptionist in a guest house. The receptionist will deal with everything from an observer position. He will think, oh, this is a very sympathetic person. He is so friendly. But he will not enter into a bond with the person. And then he sees, oh, he is a difficult person. Oh my God, he will have 1,000 demands, but he's a guest, so we should see that he will not become too upset with the person. This is an ideal position. Of course, we are not really cameras like this, so we do have reactions to things, but there is a little space between when an impulse comes to you and the reaction, and in this little gap, so to say, lies all your human freedom. I remember, oops, Anshul is a good name. Yes, Anshul. We have reached the full hour, and I will continue talking about this in the question and answer session. You please be present there, and you. I think this will make it very clear. But I want to turn. I want to respect the time of all of you who are here on this call, and it's nice if we finish properly, and then you can go and do your various tasks and responsibilities. I just wanted to say one small thing. The last session which we have in Wednesday is really a question and answer session. Now you might say, "Oh, I have no question," and also, oh, sometimes I ask things or say things which are really not something I would write in a book, you know, or so on. You may feel hesitant to ask questions for this or that reason. Oh, I'm a listening person. I didn't come to a Zoom conference to ask questions. I'm in the listening mood. But still, I want to ask you to go a little bit deep and think, is there anything that maybe stops you or holds you back for going after that little voice, the voice of the self, that tells you, you know, you're missing out on something, you know it yourself. Is there anything which is an obstacle? Because I think here I can talk very helpfully, because yes, when you're 50 years a monk, you deal with many obstacles, your own obstacles, and you need to figure out how to cross beyond them. And you, of course, I counsel many people, so I know about this. So this would be a good question, and I think we all have an obstacle in following full-heartedly the calling of this the soul, which we already know is there. We can't pretend we don't know it. At least we cannot pretend to ourselves we don't know it. We may be able to pretend to other people, but not to ourselves. So the quality of that session, last session, is very much dependent on you. Really, and you're doing this little work, and I request you, do your work, sit down over the week, and then we have a very exciting question. Otherwise, I always have things to talk about, but it's nicer if you do your work. Good, I will give over to Hari Prasad to officially end this session.
Thank you so much, Satchinandana Swami. I'm echoing everything you just said about bringing your questions. It was so artfully and wonderfully expressed. Thank you for sharing your deep wisdom with us. It's such a joy and a real honor. Thank you, everyone, for being with us and being so attentive and really hopefully trying to take these gems to heart. We ask you to please stay on with us if at all possible. There is more to come. And if not, see you next week for our last session of Q&A. Thank you. So we'll now transition. I think, Anshul, you had something more that you wanted to share just briefly before we go to the next question. And then I know, Satchinandana Swami, you also had something to share more.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Hari Prasad. So, Satchinandana Swami, on the piece of thinking about work, I heard you in terms of being in a place of observer and therefore being able to pause and to respond instead of react, and to respond in the way from that deeper sense of self. And when I think about work, there's one is how you go about doing your work. But mm-hmm. before that question is what work one is actually doing, meaning one's dharma. And so when I think about the analogy you shared earlier of stepping back so we can put a direction in the GPS, not how do we handle the bumps on the road on the drive, but which road are we actually going to, and what dharma represents our eternal soul. Would you be able to share something on the actual nature of work, and when, I know people talk about purpose and those kinds of things, but I was wondering if you might be able to just share a comment on that, please.
Yes, first of all, if you act in your dharma, then the big Dharma, which governs the whole universe, will rush to your aid. You will be almost like a bulb, an electrical bulb that is connected with the faucet and now has the electric power of the whole United States of America behind it. So acting with your Dharma is very good. Now, Dharma at work requires three things. It's like a tripod. We used to have a recording device with a tripod. So the tripod of Dharma needs to be understood. First of all is your Swadharma, what you should do as a human being in relationship to you. To find that out, you need to almost do a little personal Dharma workshop. You need to find, you can for instance ask the question, what is it that I excel in the most? Forget now everything what you're doing. Ask this question, what is it that I excel in the most? Then you will have, with this question, you come closer to your talent. And talent is something which is God-given. It is given to someone and withheld from another. And you can do what you want. You can't create a talent. It's given. You can create a skill. But talent is something different. It's something that is inborn, that is unmistakably you. What if, ask another question, if I'm left alone and I could personally do whatever I want, I don't need money and so on, what would that one thing be where I would be naturally drawn? In my case, it's very simple. I like to go deep and in spiritual practice, and I like to study, but I like to also communicate. I do it everywhere. If you put me on an airplane, soon I will have a few people I talk to around me. It's natural. And I like to sing and dance. It just comes natural. I don't know how good my talent is to sing and how good my talent to dance is, but I'm invited to do this all over the world, to sing and dance, yes. But I also explain philosophy. I'm doing that also. So that's the first, Swadharma. But you also need to have what is called Lokadharma, that is ethical behavior. This is what you do to the world. There are many pop stars who are really talented in what they do, but at least some of them I have heard lead a very unethical life, and they will not be satisfied if they don't discover this Dharma in relationship to others. And then there's the third leg on which the tripod of Dharma stands. That is what you do in relationship to God. These three things you must have in your life. In your work life, you can have the first two, Swadharma and Lokadharma, this ethical behavior. Of course, in your work life, you will also, when you are spiritually advanced, not do a type of work where you create harm and misery for others. That is naturally something you shy away from if you want to live, have proper work. I hope this answers your question to some degree of satisfaction. I have with me I hope I have it still with me. Must be there. Yes, I have a clear idea where it could be in my notes. A Dharma inquiry sheet, you know, with about, I guess, from 30 questions. And if you wish to have it, we could make a photocopy when I'm in New York, and I can either give it to Hari Prasad or to you personally if we meet.
Thank you, Sister.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Anshul. Was there anything else that you wanted to share, Satchinandana Swami, before we take the next question?
Yes. For me and for the tradition, the stepping into the observer role will keep a lot of problems away from you. My most graphic example is when I was in India a few years ago. It was very hot and I was exhausted, and all of a sudden I felt a warm drizzle coming over me, and I thought, oh, finally that rains, soon it will be cool. But when I looked up, I saw the drizzle didn't come from a cloud. It was a monkey who had aimed his private pipe on me and was putting his drizzle over me. And I don't know if you ever have smelled monkey urine. It smells really so repulsive. Oh. Ooh, and it's so difficult to get it out of the cloth because it has such a stench, I could say. So I was exhausted, my batteries had run down low, and I was very angry at this monkey. How can he do this? Now I have to hours washing my clothes, and why is such an uncivilized behavior? And I'm trying to do spiritual practice and so on. So I lost it. I just looked for a stone. I found a stone, and I was ready to just throw it into his grinning face and pay him back. At that moment, sadhu, they are called, you know, people who have a spiritual pursuit in life, saw me, and he said, don't, you know, he stopped me, and then he made a remark, I have umbrella. Then I thought, this is so ridiculous, you know, to have an umbrella. And I was still upset. As I told you, I had lost it. I had lost the connection to myself. I was just angry and disappointed. But because it was a saintly looking person, I mean, I could not now get on his case for his genuine attempt to help me in this monkey-infested area. So then I remembered, hey, the observer role. What is going on here? And at first I saw I have become very angry. Why have you become very angry? Yeah, I have become angry because I felt offended by the behavior of the monkey. Yeah, but you're not the body. You're now in this situation. Why don't you look at a distance? And then I looked at it like a theater goer, or a visitor. Theater visitor, I think we say, might look at a dramatic scene on the stage, and he will always be able to take himself back and not take it so serious and not suffer a heart attack by what is happening. He will observe from a neutral position. So when I stepped back and went into this position, my whole mood changed. I laughed and I said, okay, let's go to the shower now and take care of this. Solutions will appear. I mean, this is an obvious solution, but solutions will appear spontaneously when you step away from your emotions, which force you to just react, and you choose a wise response. This is a technique which you should learn. You know, try it in the next difficult discussion. Maybe there's at work someone who wants to take full advantage of your company and cheat you for $20 million US dollars. Then observe it and deal with him without getting heated. You might say, you're very truthful today in your offer. And make a nice gentlemanly comment which puts it on the humorous level. Whatever. Yeah. Thank you, Anshul.
Thank you, Sajjanand.
All right, thank you. So we'll go to John. John, would you ask your question?
Thank you, Hari Prasad. Hello, Sachinananda Swami. Thank you so much for being here today with us. I'm so grateful to you and to the Upbell team for the opportunity to ask my question. So last week you talked about this theme of getting the inside right, and a thread that you returned to several times over the past couple of weeks was contemplating one's own death. We had the exercise, I think, 2 weeks ago of seeing ourselves on our own deathbed, and then you also talked about having two baskets and the utility of having sort of a life and a death consideration or a basket. And then you also told the story last week about the person in the boat who capsized, and only by surrendering fully to his own death was he able to find his true self or salvation. And so my question is, could you talk more about that, you know, perhaps about this idea of the baskets, or maybe in terms of, you know, how do we properly consider our own death without it becoming a gratuitous exercise of the ego? How do we do it so it becomes so that it's productive and we can discover ourselves more deeply?
Thank you very much. This is a very deep question. There is a very nice story, a wisdom story, from which we can start. Four types of people came to a saint and received four types of blessings. There was a prince who was enjoying like anything, and that was his philosophy. And the saint said, so that you can peaceful think, you will never die. And there were a few other people, four people altogether. But then he came to a spiritual people, and he told him, a spiritual person, and he told him, you should keep death in front of your eyes. That is my blessing. So it is usually when we think about our end, our impending mortal end, a physical end, that the eternal things shine up or turn up. You know, before the idea of death, we don't spend life with wasteful moments, with wasteful activities. It helps us to see what is essential. There is a general understanding, or there was a research done, when do people become most intense in their spiritual exploration? And it's always people who see through the lie of materialistic comfort, which is a little bit dulling the soul, and who see that their life in the way is precarious, and then they really look for spiritual solutions or real solutions to their material problems, because they know in the face of losing everything, what can you do instead of what can you do except for going to that one road where you can gain everything, your eternal life, love, your relationship with God, and so on. So that contemplation about one's own death should, however, not take any morbid forms, or sickly forms. The contemplation of one's own death is only done in a healthy way if one remembers who one really is, the eternal soul, then, or the eternal self. Then this is helpful. If one does not remember this or does not keep this in front of one's eyes, it will not give one the full benefit. What a wonderful question.
Thank you, Sachidananda Swami. Thank you.
Your good name is John.
John.
Yes. John, in my direct, around me, I have just been confronted with a person who's very close to me, whose two legs have to be amputated. And he turns to me, can you help me? Just a week ago, the father of someone who's very close has just dropped dead from one moment to another. And then there is another person who also has died overnight. And all these people, those who are close to these people, come, of course, and look for a spiritual counsel. And I always tell them, as long as you identify with something you are not, you will be affected. But if you identify with the eternal soul, then all these tragedies will just be a passing moment, nothing more, and lose their face, their angry face. Oh, I notice I'm still jet-lagged, like anything. I have not yet taken enough attention to the... When I come to New York, I'm very, very... I've overcome jet-lag, but today I still need to do something against this. Yes, Hari Prasad.
Thank you
so much, John. So the last question, Sam, would you kindly ask?
Hello, Sachinandana Swami.
Yes.
Thank you all for this opportunity to hear from you. So something happened today that made me very aware and present to my yearning for recognition. And I'm just wondering, what are some steps I can take to mitigate that desire?
Wonderful, Sam. How you have... That yearning for recognition is becoming exceptionally strong or exceedingly strong at moments where we forget our self-worth. And we feel only if I have if I'm valued by others, if I'm recognized by others, will I be of any worth? But if you know I have self-worth, and you are in contact with this, and I'm recognized already by, I'm loved the way I am by that supreme. I don't have to be anything or do anything or say anything to be loved. It's almost like a child who is loved a priori by the mother, even when that love is so strong, Sam, that recognition from above is so strong, that even if we don't, if we are not aware of it, still it works and surrounds us. It's almost like the child. The child is in the womb of the mother and has not any communication with the mother. The child has not said anything to the mother. It's unable to communicate. It sometimes kicks, perhaps, and with its little fists, and the mother is aware, ooh, my child is alive. But there is no communication. The mother loves the child anyways, even in the first years when the child cannot properly say anything but is just absolutely needy and dependent on the child. The mother loves it with all its her force. So in the same way, you are loved by the Supreme. The society will never be able to recognize you fully because and love you fully or appreciate you fully. It is not possible for them because they don't know who they are. You may not know absolutely who you are. It's all confused, you know. All communication lines are only artificial. They are not self to self. But still we are so dependent on it, on the recognition of others. If we lack a recognition of the supreme recognition, the supreme love and appreciation of us. And you know, Sam, you're good enough the way you are, because that's what you are. You can't be anything else than what you are, and it's good enough. You were made like this, even with the little mistakes, the little quirky things which we all have, you know. You're good the way you are because that's how you were made now. I know this need for recognition. I had it very strong in my life before being a monk because my father had really, every evening he would be there and he would say, we have to do something great. Germany was almost destroyed after the Second World War, and we are now the ones who have build it up. Germany depends on you, the next generation. I will do what I can, and so on. And we were really trimmed for a Leistungs-oriented, success-oriented life where recognition by others is, of course, very important. And I had this also when I came into the monk life. I thought, well, in my other life, I wanted to be the most important adventurer, to be recognized by my friends. Now I wanted to be known and recognized as the most austere monk who would be able to fast for a long time. And I suffered so much and I fasted so long until one day someone told me, if you are continuing to chase after recognition, it's like chasing the wind. You will never actually, it comes and goes on its own. And he reminded me, you are good enough. You are yourself. There's one place in the universe which has not been taken. That's the place of which has not been fully taken. That's the place of you. Why imitate someone else? Yeah, what a profound question. And when I'm no longer in jet lag, I will give a much better answer.
Thank you. I hope you feel better soon. I look forward to seeing you in New York.
Good.
Thank you very much, Sam. And we will close here. Satchidananda Swami, our profound gratitude to you as ever. Thank you for all that you're sharing. And great gratitude to everyone for being here so sincerely. We hope that you will come back and also see us in New York at the close of this series after next week. So please do bring your questions with you next time for our final session. We can't wait for more. Thank you all.